Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. At his second re-election rally of the week, President Trump made fun of how rival Michael Bloomberg performed on the debate stage this week.
Now, Mike didn't do too well. He went way down. It's all right. Mini Mike.
This afternoon, Trump holds his third rally of the week in Nevada, where stakes are high for the Democrats in caucuses tomorrow.
Let's bring in Sahil Kapoor, who is national politics reporter for NBC. He joins us from Las Vegas. Hi, Sahil.
Good to join you.
Well, before we get to news from the campaign trail, I want to ask you about the latest story on Russian election interference and President Trump's response to it. The New York Times and The Washington Post are both reporting that Trump's removal of his acting director of national intelligence this week and replacement with a loyal supporter was because a staffer had briefed members of Congress, including Democrats, that Russia is once again interfering in the election to favor President Trump and get him reelected. Trump was angry the Democrats were briefed on that. What do you make of this? And should Americans be concerned that the president doesn't want anyone to hear intelligence that doesn't make him look good?
Right. I mean, this is a topic that the president has always been uncomfortable with because he believes it the idea of Russian interference, true though it may be, undermines his victory in 2016 and sort of delegitimizes his presidency in a way. And the big news here seems to be that the president was, according to the New York Times, upset with the director of national intelligence for briefing Congress, which is his job to do, which kind of suggests that the president wants his officials, even career officials in an area like intelligence, to act in ways that comport with his political interests. And that seems to be one of the big takeaways from his move here.
Okay. And one other story out of Washington I want to get your thoughts on. One of the foreign wars that President Trump has campaigned on ending this morning, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the U.S. and the Taliban have reached an understanding that could lead to a reduction in violence in Afghanistan and a possible end to America's longest war. We are a little over 8 months until the election here in this country. Are politics at play in what's happening in Afghanistan that President Trump wants to show he's kept his promise about ending the war there before the voters vote?
Without a doubt, he wants to show that. There are a lot of ifs here. This appears to be a 7-day reduction in violence between the United States and Afghanistan, and in a war that has been fought between these two countries for about 2 decades now. It is far from clear that this will ultimately lead to peace. If it does, if there are major breakthroughs in the coming months, and the president can realistically say that his actions have led to that, then certainly it will help him, because one of the things he campaigned on was ending United States entanglements in foreign wars. It is still a war-weary country that wants a lot less of that.
Sahil, hey, let's turn to the Democrats running for president. You're in Las Vegas. Bernie Sanders is the clear front runner now for the Democratic presidential nomination. The campaigns of Mike Bloomberg and Pete Buttigieg are now pressing each other to drop out to consolidate the votes of moderates for one candidate who can stop Sanders. At this point, I'm wondering from you, is the moderate lane so much in flux that Sanders is likely unstoppable?
That is absolutely the fear of many figures in the Democratic establishment, that there's just a traffic jam in the moderate lane with Pete Buttigieg, Mike Bloomberg, Joe Biden. Amy Klobuchar is also still in the mix, had a really good showing in New Hampshire. The first three men I mentioned are private citizens. They don't have a public office to fall back on. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of money. They don't have any reason to drop out. And all of them believe it should be them and nobody else. So, yes, I think there is an issue here for figures in the Democratic Party who want to coalesce around an alternative to Bernie Sanders, because the polls here in Nevada, the polls nationally, the polls in key states like California and Texas show him far ahead of the field and clearly, as you mentioned, the front runner for this nomination.
Yeah, yeah. Back to Mike Bloomberg, though, who isn't on the ballot in Nevada, made his case in Utah last night, which voters on Super Tuesday, March 3rd, will vote. Let's listen.
Look, the real winner in the debate last night was Donald Trump. Because I worry that we may very well be on the way to nominating somebody who cannot win in November. And if we choose a candidate who appeals to a small base like Senator Sanders, it will be a fatal error.
Sahil, there's a poll out yesterday in Nevada that has Sanders in first at 30%, followed by Buttigieg at 17% and Biden at 16%. You kind of laid out the power of Sanders, but what are you hearing from voters?
There is an electability battle happening between these candidates. That is the coin of the realm in the Democratic primary. Every Democratic voter is obsessed with the idea of finding a candidate who can win the general election. They know they have one bite at this apple to stop him from becoming a two-term president, and they don't want to mess it up. Now, what you hear from Sanders and what you hear from Bloomberg are two very different theories of the case. Mike Bloomberg wants to take a somewhat traditional path, win over centrist voters, win over the moderate kind of affluent suburban urbanites who powered Democrats into the majority in the House of Representatives in 2018. Bernie Sanders has a very different theory of the case. He looks at the 100 million people who sat out the election in 2016 and says they are disaffected voters who believe neither party is looking out for them. He wants a surge in turnout. He wants an exciting, bold message of disruption and change. And he wants to change the shape of the electorate and win by mobilizing new voters. So that's the choice facing Democratic voters. Which of those theories sounds better to them? Which candidate do they want to go with?
It was interesting to hear the question in the debate this week about whether the candidate who has amassed the most delegates at the end of the process, even if they don't have a majority, should be the candidate chosen at the convention. And Bernie Sanders was the only one who said yes to that. Obviously, he thinks he's going to be the one. And the other candidates said no, it should follow the normal process. What do you think about a contested convention? We talk about this every 4 years, but this time it actually seems like it could happen.
You know, it always seems like it could happen until the party establishment sits in a room and figures out that it would break apart whatever was left of the party if they were to, you know, take away the nomination from the plurality delegate leader. I have a very, very hard time seeing it. We're going to hear a lot of hand-wringing between now and the convention about that possibility. There's going to be a lot of, you know, prominent Democrats who fear that Bernie Sanders would lose the election in a major way to President Trump. But if he is the clear delegate leader heading into the convention, I don't see a plausible argument that anybody could make that would keep the party together, because his voters are diehards. They're not going to show up. They're not going to show up to support Democrats if the nomination is perceived as being stolen from him. This was even a problem in 2016 when he clearly lost the nomination to Hillary Clinton. But there was some question of whether the process was designed right in a way to benefit Hillary Clinton. And later on, emails came out that spoke to that. And a lot of Bernie Sanders voters either stayed home or voted for Jill Stein. About a tenth of them voted for Donald Trump
right
in 2016.
Right.
So it is it should be a major concern among
Democrats. Let me just add one voice to this conversation for a few minutes here. Enrique Acevedo joins us. He's a news anchor for Univision. Enrique, Univision polling found 1 in 3 Latino voters in Nevada are willing to vote for Bernie Sanders, followed by Biden and then Steyer. This is the race, the part of the process that everybody looks to say, how are Latinos feeling? What are you hearing?
I think it's the first stop in our electoral calendar that's going to test the Latino strategy in each campaign. I think that's a fair assumption, Jeremy. And it's surprising to see that Sanders has retained that lead he had from the beginning. He's still polling as a leader among Latino candidates, according to this poll, followed by Joe Biden and then, surprisingly, Mike Bloomberg. And I say surprisingly because he entered the race, you know, very late and, right, and hasn't been part of any debate or hasn't been on a ballot until now. So what surprises me specifically about Nevada is the fact that this culinary union, that it's mainly formed by Latinos, over 50% of its members are Latinos, have healthcare in their minds and have really had this contentious relationship with the Sanders campaign over healthcare, over keeping their healthcare plan, and still with that influence and that power that the union has, Bernie Sanders seems to be the favorite candidate amongst Latinos in the state. So it's going going to be interesting to see how they vote at the end and the real muscle and the strength of this culinary union.
Yeah. Enrique, looking to the future, we have another debate coming up Tuesday night. What are the stakes for yet another debate? The same six, including Michael Bloomberg, will be on the stage in Charleston ahead of the primary there. Your thoughts?
I think that first debate was pretty bad for issues that Latino voters care about, and these are the issues that most of the voters care about. There wasn't a lot of talk about things like gun control, things like jobs and the economy. There was a lot of back and forth on other issues, but I think Latino voters want to hear more specifics about not just their immigration plans, which of course wasn't part of the first debate, but also how are they going to benefit from this economy. Over 60% of the people who were who participated in our poll said that they don't feel they benefited from Trump's economic policies, despite the fact that Hispanic unemployment is at an all-time low. So that's very significant if you think that President Trump and the White House have been talking about this for a long time and say that that alone is going to win them Latino support. Well, 60% of Latinos on a national level and around the same number in Nevada are saying we have not felt that benefit.
That's Enrique Acevedo. He's a news anchor for Univision. And Sahil Kapoor is national political correspondent for NBC. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's jump right into our social media roundup, where we look at what's creating buzz online. Joining us now is Carly Severn, a social media strategist and reporter at KQED. Hey, Carly.
Hey, Tonya.
Okay, so first, let's look at how this week's 2020 Democratic debate played out online. And let's start with Twitter. You know, for me, it is so fascinating to see the evolution of conversation about politics on this medium. Of course, there were hot takes, but it also kind of served as a supplemental space, meaning there were conversations about policy and actions from the candidates and past actions, basically a lot of context brought to these Twitter conversations. I'm just wondering from you, do you see this as an evolution of the medium?
I kind of do. I mean, according to Twitter's own data, the three most tweeted moments in this debate were, number one, Bloomberg on Sanders saying, you know, that line about the best known socialist in the country happens to be a millionaire with three houses. Number two was Warren defending Klobuchar for not knowing the Mexican president's name. And number three, that kind of iconic line from the moderator asking Mike Bloomberg, should you exist? So it's really interesting seeing these three key moments that get picked up. And talking about the value of Twitter and these social conversations around the debates, a lot of people are concerned about like a loss of nuance. But a lot of the commentators I saw were doing incredible work. For example, Yamiche Alcindor from PBS NewsHour, she did this great tweet where she recapped Bloomberg's first half of the debate. And she said, this looks nothing like his ads, which is just a fascinating summation. You get live fact-checking. Also, you can get this rapid response from public figures. I was really struck by AOC's retort to Jennifer Rubin of The Washington Post, who called Elizabeth Warren mean and angry. She can retort straight away on Twitter and say something like, anger at injustice is quite appropriate. But the biggest thing I want to say here is that Twitter is not the United States. If you're using Twitter as your temperature check, that is incorrect because Twitter is younger, it is more democratic, it is more educated than the general population.
An important note to take, absolutely. I want to turn now to the problem of online bullying. So British TV star Caroline Flack died by suicide last weekend, and she had faced some pretty intense scrutiny online over allegations that she had assaulted her boyfriend. And a few days after her death, 18-year-old singer Billie Eilish spoke to the BBC about how she has stopped reading Instagram comments about herself because of the effect it was having on her.
I stopped reading comments fully.
Because?
Because it was ruining my life. It's weird. Like, the cooler the things you get to do are, the more people hate you. It's crazy.
You know, I mean, my goodness, Carly, Eilish really brings up a good point. She tells presenters that she didn't know and she doesn't know how to fix this. This is really an important topic because these tech platform companies still don't have a handle on it. I mean, has Instagram or any of the platforms really taken on mental health and trolling in this way?
That video is a really hard watch, I must say. The thing is, nothing really effective is being done on Instagram or, in fact, anywhere else about policing comments. And I think this is really important to talk about. Is this a mental health issue, as, you know, this phrase comes up again, or is this a cruelty online issue? You get anonymity, you get a profile, and you get the ability to join a tribe as well.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, before I let you go, can we talk about this Lovers and Friends Festival?
Seriously,
everybody
can we?
I know has been posting about it asking, is this real? For those who don't know, it's this event in LA that's supposed to happen where just about every R&B and rap name you can think of is supposedly scheduled to perform. Lauryn Hill, Usher, TLC, Snoop Dogg. But I mean, I'm just wondering, it feels a lot like that Fyre Festival, like it could be too good to be true. What are you hearing about this?
Oh, my gosh. People see this lineup and they think it's too good to be true even before things start getting weird. And they did start getting weird because a few of the acts like Lil' Kim and Mace and Twista, they start denying that they're even involved. Mm. And fans are noticing that like Megan Thee Stallion and T-Pain, aren't they meant to be somewhere else on that specific date? So people obviously start wondering, is this a scam? Is this another Fyre Festival? But enter Snoop Dogg. Snoop Dogg is behind this whole thing. He comes out, he publicly says that he's one of the booking agents. He's wrangling the talent. And he says, Lil Kim, DM me. Let's get you your money. So this appears to have all been, I don't know, some kind of giant accounting snafu, which is a pretty funny glimpse behind the curtain, quite frankly.
I'll watch from my couch. Carly Severn is social media strategist and reporter at KQED in San Francisco. Carly, thank you.
Thank you.
On Monday, thousands of people are expected to attend the public memorial service for Kobe Bryant at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. The impact of the basketball legend's death was felt this week at the NBA's All-Star Game, where athletes and stars delivered moving tributes. It's a shared grief for a man most of us did not know personally. And as our next guest tells us, the way we feel is perfectly normal. Earl Turner is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor of psychology at Pepperdine University. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Dr. Earl, how did you learn about this fatal accident that killed Kobe and his daughter and several others? And how have you grieved?
I was actually at home, like most of us, and caught the news through, I believe, Instagram, and I was in shock, like most people. And so I waited around and watched the news for several hours that day until I decided that I needed to, like, personally just sort of take a breather from all of the information. And I've said to several people that, you know, although I wasn't a Lakers fan, he still had a significant impact in terms of how I responded to, you know, his life and his contribution to the sport, but also how he shared his family with us.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about when Prince died, and I thought about how really I had never known life without him. Some of my first memories in life were his music. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that's a big part of why grief hits us so deeply with celebrities, because even though we don't know them, we feel like we do.
Yeah, I think a big part of it, especially in Kobe's situation, is that because we witnessed him so much through the television, through watching sports, through learning about, you know, his family and what he did for the community in Los Angeles, that it impacted us in terms of how we viewed him as a person and humanized him, because oftentimes we look at athletes as sort of these supernatural beings.
Yeah.
But I also think that being able to see things in him as a person, so for most of us being able to be competitive or be the best at our craft, was a big part of how he left an impact on the world.
I want to talk a little bit about the public emotion we witnessed, specifically from men, because crying and really expressing emotion is not something that we often see or society deems as masculine. Yet we have grown men who are openly mourning Kobe Bryant. Here's Shaquille O'Neal speaking about Kobe during a pregame show on TNT a few weeks ago.
We up here, we work a lot. And I think a lot of times we take stuff for granted. Like, I don't talk to you guys as much as I need to. The fact that we're not going to be able to joke at his Hall of Fame ceremony. We're not going to be able to say, hi, I got 5, you got 4. The fact that we're not going to be able to say, if we would stay together, we could have got 10. Those are the things that you can't get back. And with the loss of my father, my sister, and my pain. That's the only thing I wish I could just say something to him.
Man, you know, I always tear up when I hear men cry because it's something we just don't see publicly often. How significant is this?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that oftentimes men are encouraged to shield their emotional expressions, particularly when it comes to sadness or hurt or disappointment. We are taught from a very young age that you have to always be tough. And the only emotion that is okay for us to have is anger. Mm-hmm. And so I think this clip really shows that it's healthy to be able to release that emotion. And so when you sort of hold those things inside, it actually makes it more likely that you're going to have difficulties in terms of processing that situation. So this releasing of that emotion is really healthy.
And that it's natural and it's pure and it's right because men are humans.
Right, exactly.
I'm wondering, is engaging in social media more helpful or harmful for someone while processing this grieving? There's so much that we're bombarded with, you know? Every time I go on Instagram, I think one of the first things that comes up when I open up the app is a photo of Kobe still, just all these weeks later.
Yeah. I think you have to be able to understand your own emotional reactions to those things. I think that Instagram and social media can be helpful in a lot of ways because it may provide opportunities for you to be, in so many words, distracted by other things that may be going on and share other happy moments. But I also think that you can get inundated with so much information and so many images. Those things can provide an additional trigger. So I think it's important that you allow yourself to step away from those things. And maybe that's deleting the app. Maybe it's, you know, taking a break for a couple of hours so that you don't continue to process that information, which could potentially be traumatic.
You brought up how important it is for young people to actually see men expressing emotion. And I'm thinking about the number of young people who admired Kobe Bryant. How can parents help their kids process Kobe's death?
Well, I think one of the most helpful ways is, one, to be able to just talk about that experience in terms of, you know, how you're feeling about it. So I think that this is a unique opportunity to be able to show kids how do you process grief and how do you talk about those emotional reactions to that situation. The other thing I think that is helpful is that you allow your child a way to be able to celebrate and honor the life of Kobe. And so that could be through attending some of the ceremonies, which could, again, bring up some of those emotional reactions again. But I think it can also foster healing.
Yeah. Children and adults alike.
Yes.
Yep. Earl Turner is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor of psychology at Pepperdine University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
South Korea is the latest front in the battle to stop COVID-19, the illness caused by the new coronavirus. NPR's Anthony Kuhn joins us from Seoul. And Anthony, the prime minister says South Korea has entered an emergency phase of COVID-19. What are you seeing?
It's just a sort of an amazing shift of focus. The country was previously focused on keeping this virus out of the country. Then all of a sudden it pops up inside the country in the heartland. In the country's fourth largest city, which is called Daegu, population about 2.5 million. And just in the past 2 days, the case numbers have doubled twice, from about 50 to 100, then 100 to 200. And most of these new cases are in Daegu, and most of them are related to a church group called the Shincheonji Church of Jesus. Authorities believe that hundreds of adherents of this church may have been infected at large church services. They say about more than 500 now have symptoms of coronavirus, so the numbers of cases could increase very quickly.
How is the government responding? Is everything shut down?
Certainly not in Seoul. I mean, in Daegu, a lot of things are shut down, libraries, schools, and they're running short of hospital beds and medicines and equipment. There have been some infections in Seoul. So here they have canceled a lot of mass events, particularly political rallies, which happen in the capital on the weekends. The World Health Organization in Geneva says South Korea's case numbers are still manageable. And just because there's been this big spike in cases over the past 2 days doesn't mean coronavirus is going to turn into some global pandemic necessarily.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this church group. Do health officials know how the illness actually got to South Korea or how it's spreading? Do you know if this church group had traveled in any way?
It takes time to sort these things out. And one suspicion is that this church does have branches in China. So what investigators are looking for, of course, is people going back and forth between the branches in South Korea and China.
I understand that some members of the military have also been infected.
That's right. In all the service branches, Army, Navy, and Air Force, a lot of troops are confined to base. Also, the U.S. Army has a garrison in Daegu near the church, and some people on that base have gone to the church, and so those bases are now restricting travel in and out.
One more question. This is probably a harder one. No way to really know this, but do we have any indication that COVID-19 has reached North Korea? And if so, what would be the fears about containing it there?
Yeah, North Korea has been saying for days now that it has no cases. It's reported this to the WHO, that it's tested patients and all have come up negative. And they've shut their border with China and cut transport links. And they've canceled a lot of events such as the spring Pyongyang Marathon. But experts are very skeptical about this. They say past epidemics have, you know, they've never been able to stop them from coming in from China. And the country is plagued by things like chronic malnutrition, a lack of running water and electricity and sanitation. They're desperately short of basic medical supplies, such as disposable gloves and masks. So both the U.S. and South Korea say they're willing to help either through governments or through aid groups to go in there and distribute these supplies.
That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Seoul. Thank you, as always.
You're welcome, Tanya.
Tomorrow's caucuses in Nevada will mark a turning point in the presidential race. It's the first ethnically diverse state to vote in the 2020 Democratic primary and the first state where labor unions will play a decisive role in the outcome. Here in Now's Peter O'Dowd is in Las Vegas, where those two powerful forces are often one in the same.
Hello?
This is a political machine at work.
This is Chris from the Culinary Union. How are you doing today?
Members of the Culinary Union are pounding the phones to get their fellow casino servers and laundry workers to show up on caucus day tomorrow. The Culinary Union represents 60,000 hospitality workers in Nevada, and its membership looks almost nothing like the voters in Iowa or New Hampshire. They come from 178 different countries, speak more than 40 different languages, and nearly 80% are Latino, Asian, or Black. Mario Sandoval is a proud voter, union member, and server at Binion's Casino.
In the steakhouse. I've been in that same room for 35 years.
What's the energy around caucus week? Because I know the energy in Las Vegas is always high, but like, is it different now?
The buzz is here. It's at work.
Sandoval caucused early this year, and according to the rules, he was allowed to mark three names on the ballot.
Tom Steyer sticks out to me like a sore thumb.
In a good way.
In a very good way. So does Joe Biden. And then I picked Pete.
Number three.
Three.
Sandoval is an immigrant and a cancer survivor, and he doesn't want anyone messing with his union health plan.
You can't argue with me about our health care. It saved my life, you know. If I didn't have this health care, I probably wouldn't be here.
Which is why he supported a moderate like Tom Steyer.
He believes in health care for all, you know, not just, but choice, you know. He believes in DACA, TPS. I mean, those are all important to me, you know, especially because, you know, my mom brought me here when I was young. I was undocumented. I got documented after I came over.
We've been asking people around the country what their dream would be in 2020. What's their American dream? What does the American dream mean to you in 2020? And I wonder what your answer to that question is.
I've lived the American dream to me. I've got my kids. I bought a home. But in 2020, I don't care what the Democrats do, but they just need to get Trump out of office for 2020. That's really what needs to happen to me.
And that is something the union's leadership can agree with.
My dream is to defeat President Trump.
Gioconda Arguello-Klein is Culinary Secretary Treasurer and the public face of a union that is majority female.
I don't have him anymore as a president because I see how he makes suffer the families. And that upset me a lot because I'm a mother.
But the process of nominating a Democrat who can make her dream come true has already proven difficult. Last week, Culinary sent a candidate scorecard to its members that said frontrunner Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan would jeopardize and replace the union's health coverage. And remember how Mario Sandoval felt about that.
You can't argue with me about our health care.
Because Culinary's health care plan is widely considered the best in Nevada. There's even a health clinic just for its members. But Arguello-Klein didn't predict how severe the backlash would be when she spoke out to protect it.
After we did that scorecard, we've been under attack.
By Bernie Sanders supporters?
Yes. We've been an incredible under attack, and the attack is being to the two women of color, to Bethany Khan, she's our communication director, and to myself.
Well, tell me about what kind of threats you're talking about.
Well, threat like you're never going to be able to work anymore, like physical threat, calling names, because I came from Nicaragua, and I came in 1979, had political asylum, accused me for terrible sins. You know, I've been in this country 40 years. This is my country.
The dust-up between Culinary and the Sanders campaign became such a big deal that Pete Buttigieg forced Sanders to address it in Wednesday's debate.
Most Americans believe we need to empower workers. As a matter of fact, you're the one who is at war with the Culinary Union right here in Las Vegas.
We are more union support than you have ever dreamed of.
And then he said this.
We have over 10.6 million people on Twitter, and 99.9% of them are decent human beings, are working people, are people who believe in justice, compassion, and love. And if there are a few people who make ugly remarks, who attack trade union leaders, I disown those people. They are not part of our movement.
So, how did a union of immigrant cooks, bartenders, and kitchen workers develop enough power to become a major talking point in a presidential contest? To find out, I went to the Palms Casino in Las Vegas.
Who got the power?
We got the power!
Union power!
Just hours before the debate, Arguello-Klein was leading a picket line of workers. The union hasn't endorsed a candidate, but the event attracted most of them. Elizabeth Warren, Tom Steyer, Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar. They called on the resort to recognize a 2018 vote by its workers to unionize. And that's where I asked UNLV law professor Ruben Garcia to meet me a few hours after the crowds dispersed.
Was it any surprise to you that an event like that happened a couple of days before caucusing?
It wasn't a surprise to me because one of the goals of the union has been to connect its political action, political activity, with its actions to get more workers covered by the culinary workers contract.
Garcia has followed labor's social and legal impact on Nevada for years.
The union is more than 85 years old, so it is has a lot of history behind it in terms of building, you know, not just yesterday or, you know, last year, but building a strong labor movement for, you know, 80 years or more. So I think that I think in my research I've found a number of sort of elements of their success. One is their political action and political activity. Another is their engagement with immigrants and immigration issues. And also, again, they're trying to show their value to their members through contract victories, through better health care benefits than are available to many other unionized workers actually in the valley, and also contract provisions provisions that actually assist the members in terms of their immigration issues.
In fact, the union says that it's helped 18,000 immigrants become U.S. citizens since 2001. And Culinary isn't the only union in town.
Our community is now realizing that we have to go out there and vote.
Grace Vergara Mokhtal heads up SEIU Local 1107, a union that represents hospital and public sector workers across the state. And when she says our community, she's referring to Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, or API. It's the fastest growing ethnic group in Nevada, which now makes up about 10% of the population. And Vergara Mokhtal says up to 70% of SEIU's hospital workers. The union hasn't endorsed a candidate, but it's urging its members to vote.
In 2016, we helped Senator Cortez Masto get elected. And in 2018, the API votes helped to put the first Democratic governor in 20 years. So when we talk to the API community, they vote and they really make a difference. That's why you see a lot of candidates right now that are courting the API community. API was always an afterthought in the past. It shouldn't be.
And this is personal for you because I understand you immigrated yourself from the Philippines.
I did. I came here as an adult sometime 30 years ago. And I was told, when you're in the Philippines, you were told that coming to America is a life-changing. You know, it's the land of opportunity. It's a great land, right? I came here and I can see that it is, but at the same time, my first job is at $3.50, mopping floors and the video store. Mm. And then I was able to push myself to work at Kaiser Permanente, and they have union.
Well, and look at you now. You're in charge. Do you think your own story demonstrates what's going on with the Asian American community in Nevada?
I think so.
So I asked the union leader that same question we've been asking Americans around the country. What's her dream for 2020?
My American dream is that people have the same opportunity that I have.
And to Vergara Mokhtal, that means strong labor unions and health care for all, something many Nevada Democrats will have in mind when they caucus tomorrow. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Las Vegas.
A massive swarm of locusts that has zoomed across South Asia, the Middle East, and Africa has now touched down in Uganda and also in South Sudan, a country already plagued by war and hunger. The insects pose a major threat to crops. NPR's East Africa correspondent Eder Peralta has been tracking the locusts and caught up with them last month in Kenya.
Maybe I can put my microphone close to them. You might be able to hear sounds they are making with their legs as they mate, which I know is pretty gross.
Well, Eder joins me now from Nairobi. Hi, Eder.
Hey, Jeremy.
And where is the swarm now? Has it moved on from Kenya to South Sudan?
So we're actually talking multiple swarms. And I mean, and they're covering just a really vast area here in East Africa. You have them in Ethiopia, Somalia, Kenya, all the way to northern Tanzania, and now, as you mentioned, in Uganda and in South Sudan. And these regions, they've seen locusts before, but just not in these numbers. Worldwide, this is the worst infestation in a quarter century. And in Kenya, it is the worst in 70 years. And, you know, one of the big problems is that in Kenya and Ethiopia, these guys have moved from the more arid regions into the farming regions. And to compound that, it has not stopped raining here. And locusts like moist ground to lay eggs. So right now they're breeding and laying eggs. And in a few weeks, they're going to hatch and they're going to grow. And growing locusts, they're actually way hungrier than mating locusts. And so just to give you an idea of how voracious these guys are, one expert told me that a swarm the size of Manhattan And yes, I mean, some of the swarms are that big, will eat the same amount as every human in New York and California.
Well, and the big concern, obviously, as you mentioned there, is the devastation to the crops. The UN just issued a report warning that more than 6 million people, that's half of South Sudan's population, could face acute food insecurity in the coming months because of the crop damage from the locusts.
It's a lot. It's actually, you know, so not much has gone right from South Sudan. First, you had a bad drought, and it was followed by the rains, and that led to massive flooding. And South Sudan is still dealing with the effects of 5 years of civil war. So a locust invasion, it's just the last thing that South Sudan needs. And the thing that experts are warning about is that this is just a very fragile country, and anything, I mean, even if these locusts, even if it's a small invasion, it could mean very serious suffering for the South Sudanese.
What is the government of South Sudan doing to deal with it?
Not much. And in a lot of ways, that tells you why this invasion has gotten so big. Yemen and Somalia, both war-torn countries, haven't been able to do much to control this invasion. And so that has given the locusts a chance to breed without interruption. And locust experts worry that the same thing could happen in South Sudan.
Now, if this were to happen in the United States, I imagine the government would have the resources to do something about it. What is the best way to wipe out locusts? They've, of course, been around so long, they're recorded in the Bible, the plagues of locusts.
Yeah, I mean, so the only way to deal with them effectively is to spray pesticides from the air. And that doesn't mean you're going to wipe them out. It just means that you can control the numbers. Kenya has planes in the air, and so does Ethiopia. But what is clear is that the response is just not robust enough. The FAO, which is the Food and Agriculture Organization for the UN, says the number of planes has to be doubled. And they're just really worried that if dramatic measures are not taken right now, this region could be dealing with the consequences for a long time.
As we mentioned at the top, Ader, you saw the locusts. It must have been quite a sight.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, we were essentially walking over them, driving over them, and they were mating. So they were on the ground laying eggs, but as you approached them, they flew and they formed clouds. So there are now billions of these pests all over East Africa. And I mean, what's sort of amazing scientifically about them is that normally they're just brown grasshoppers. They're solitary, they live in the desert, and really they're just trying to survive. But when the rains come, there's a lot of food, and they change color. They go from brown to bright yellow, and they get high on serotonin, and they start eating and mating like crazy. And all of these locusts that we have here now, they moved from the Middle East to Africa, and three different cyclones sort of made conditions perfect for them to mate, and thousands turned into hundreds of thousands, into millions, and now billions. Every 3 months, their population increases 20-fold.
That is NPR's Ader Peralta in Nairobi, Kenya. Ader, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
You know, Tanya, with all the politics we're following, we want to make sure we make time on the show regularly for some of the signs of climate change that we're seeing. Last week, we talked about that almost 70-degree day in Antarctica, and now a plague of locusts in Africa that could get worse next month.
Very important. Absolutely.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.